You're listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. Welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Sunday, November 7th. Today is Monday, November 8th, but we are reading the paper for Sunday, November 7th. Support for this reading comes from the DePaco R.W. Hoffer Foundation. I'm Bernadette.
I'm Lois.
And here is our first story.
From Milk Pail to Slice. Behind the scenes at local Wisconsin cheese factories. Fenimore, Wisconsin. Plant manager Dylan Potts' gloved hands positioned a 40-pound brick of soft cheese tightly against the side of a machine, just as a mechanism slowly pushed the cream-colored block through a crisscrossed grid of sharpened wires. Halved by the wires, the soft cheese blocks that emerged from the initial slicing were fed into another machine called a cutter, which methodically scythed the half blocks into uniformly sized slices. Potts gathered up 10 pounds of sliced cheese in his hands as they emerged from the cutter and placed them on paper-lined trays for baking as Sid Cook looked on. "We started making this cheese about 10 years ago," said Cook. Cook is the owner of Car Valley Cheese, a more than 100-year-old cheesemaking firm with manufacturing plants in Fenimore and three other Wisconsin cities, a cutting, packaging, and distribution facility in Portage, and retail locations in 6 cities. Car Valley Cheese also is sold at local grocery stores. On this day in Fenimore, about a dozen employees worked on various aspects of the process of producing what Car Valley labels bread cheese, cutting bricks of cheese into individual pieces, baking the cut cheese at about 575 degrees for several minutes, and then immediately chilling it to prepare for packaging. Bread cheese is a type of soft cheese that originated in Finland and is served warm as a breakfast food, snack, or dessert. In Finland, they can make it with reindeer milk, but here we use cow milk, Cook said. About 20 miles southeast of Fenimore, Don Barnard watched as a robotic machine pulled planks laden with 23-pound blocks of Alpine-style creamy cheese from shelves towering multiple stories above his head in Platteville. The robot flipped the cheese block, smearing it with bacterial culture used to produce a protective skin around the cheese called a rind. "We have to smear these on almost a daily basis, so we have robots that are pulling the planks out, smearing the cheese blocks, and then setting them back in on their shelves," said Barnard, plant manager of the Emmy Roth facility in Platteville. Emmy Roth is the U.S. subsidiary of Switzerland-based Emmy Group, a dairy products firm with 5,400 employees in 13 countries. "This is one of the most automated plants Emmy Roth has," Barnard said. "You will not see many people, but a lot of automation, a lot of robots that are doing the work that traditionally used to be done by hand." Both located in Grant County, Car Valley and Emmy Roth contribute to Wisconsin's standing as America's top cheese-producing state. And although their operations differ in degrees of human labor versus automation, both facilities produce cheese, a ubiquitous dairy product that has been refined during the course of many centuries through a balanced combination of research and intuition. It's like they always say, it's a science and an art, Barnard said. From 10 pounds of milk, we get about 1 pound of cheese.
Benton buries native son killed at Pearl Harbor. On the night of December 6, 1941, Harold Carney went to sleep aboard the USS Oklahoma, moored at Fort Island, Pearl Harbor. The next morning, Carney became one of the 2,403 Americans killed in the Pearl Harbor attack that would lead to the United States to enter World War II. The Navy machinist mate, first class, was 23. His remains were assumed to be among the unidentified remains eventually buried at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific. Now, 80 years later, Harold Carney's remains have returned home. On Saturday, his living nieces and nephews gathered at St. Patrick's Church Cemetery in Benton to lay J. Carney to rest alongside his parents and his brother, John Carney. In addition to representation from local veterans group, more than 100 members of the public came out to honor him as well. We're thrilled, overjoyed about bringing him back to his family, niece Patricia Joy said. We can't get over what all the military branches have done to do this. In 1915, the Defense POW/MIA accounting agent exhumed the remains of those who were on the USS Oklahoma and began using dental, anthropological, and DNA analysis to finally identify the men. A few months ago, Joyce and her son received an unexpected call from the agency, alerting them that her uncle's remains had been identified. All of Carney's siblings have since died. They'd be as moved as I am, Joyce said. It's a very significant thing for the family. Joyce, the oldest of Carney's nieces and nephews, is the only one who still remembers him. Carney and his brother John both were serving in the U.S. Navy and stationed at Pearl Harbor in 1940. In 1941, the brothers came home for Thanksgiving. On his way back to Hawaii, Harold Carney stopped to visit his sister in Kansas City, giving 3-year-old Joyce a gift before he left. He gave me a red tricycle, Joyce said. I have a very vivid memory of him. The brothers made it back to Pearl Harbor in early December, but John Carney was still on leave in Honolulu on the day of the attack. He survived and served in the war before dying in an electrical accident in 1946. Joyce was just old enough to remember how the family mourned her uncles. We hardly had a reunion that Harold and my other uncle weren't mentioned, Joyce said.
People who make a difference. Women link friendship, volunteerism by sewing items for stillborn babies. 3 retired elementary school teachers have made nearly 350 sets of clothes and blankets since 2019, with hopes of surpassing 500 this year. By Kaylee Reese. Epworth, Iowa. Michelle Klesner was looking for something to do following her retirement as a Farley Elementary school teacher. I knew I wanted to do something to volunteer after I retired, but I didn't know what, said Klesner of Epworth. Klesner heard about a Utah-based nonprofit called Teeny Tears, which brings together volunteers who sew clothing and blankets for stillborn babies at 2,500 hospitals around the world. Klesner pulled together a group of friends and fellow Farley Elementary retirees to help with the project. Marna Hines of Farley and Mary Jane Gleason of Dyersville said they all meet at Klesner's house to cut out fabric for their pieces, and then they all sew at their own homes when they can. The three women said they work well together as a trio, especially having worked together as teachers previously. They also said they enjoy an excuse to get together to work on something, even though it can be hard to think about the stillborn babies for whom they sew. The women all have been sewing for years, both for personal use and to donate items to others. "I used to sew all my clothes and my children's clothes," Hines said, "so it was nice to find a project like this." Klesner added Joan Markson of Epworth and Jan Supple of Cascade also helped the group by getting all of the blankets and clothes ready to be sent to hospitals and funeral homes. The group has been making the clothes since 2019. Klesner said the efforts usually pick up during the winter months, though Hines and Gleason noted that Klesner makes kits year-round. Since then, Klesner, Hines, and Gleason have made nearly 350 sets of clothes and blankets. "We're hoping to hit 500 this year," Klesner said. The kits include a blanket, outfit, and cloth diapers for each baby, all of which must be made from flannel material due to the baby's soft skin. Klesner added that two baby hats also are included in the kits, one for the baby to wear and one for the parents to keep. "We're helping someone that can't help themselves," Gleason said, about providing the clothes. Klesner said the items have gone locally to both Unity Point Health, Findlay Hospital, and Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center, as well as Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory and Reef Funeral Home. Items also have been sent to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids and the Preemie Project in Iowa City before that project ended this year. Klesner added that her niece works at St. Vincent Hospital in Portland, Oregon, so the group also sends clothes there. "Hopefully in a sad time, looking at the kits brings families some kind of comfort, and they know that somebody cared," Hines said.
City okays a housing investment project. The plan will provide forgivable loans for development projects on Central Avenue from 11th to 22nd Street. The City of Dubuque leaders are committed to extra investment along one of the major downtown roadways. City Council members recently voted unanimously to create a pilot program that will provide forgivable loans for housing development projects along the stretch of Central Avenue. The program will provide individual rehabilitation projects with loans of $10,000 per housing unit developed and will be offered exclusively for properties on Central Avenue from 11th to 22nd Street. Council members have identified the revitalization of the Central Avenue corridor as a priority for years, and efforts have included the creation of a Central Avenue corridor streetscape master plan in 2019. Jill Connors, Economic Development Director for the city, said the new program largely mirrors the city's downtown rehabilitation grant program. However, the Central Avenue program will also allow for the rehabilitation of properties that are inhabited, along with devoting funds specifically for Central Avenue housing project. "Even if it's occupied, if you are doing a substantial enough investment that will put back on the market quality affordable housing, it allows for more historic properties along that corridor to qualify for the program." Dan Lobianco, Executive Director of Dubuque Main Street, said the Central Avenue project continues to have the most vacant upper-story housing units in the downtown area. He commended the city's efforts to increase investment in the area. About 45% of downtown vacancies are in that stretch. We think this is the time for the city to give extra attention to Central Avenue. To qualify for the program, developers must make an initial investment of at least $500,000, and the loan will become forgivable after 10 years. Connor said, "The lifespan of the loans ensures the city can guarantee the quality of the product for a prolonged period of time." "You are in an agreement with the city for 10 years," she said. "If you fall out of compliance with the city, then the city would have recourse on that funding. This gives the city more control over the outcome of that project." The city initially is investing $200,000 in capital improvement project funds into the program, which will be available until June 30th. Depending on the interest and success of the program, Connor said, she would recommend extending the program further. City Council member Danny Spank, whose ward includes the Central Avenue corridor, offered praise for the new program. "I wish we could put another zero behind this," Spank said. "We know the Central Avenue corridor needs attention, and this is a great start to a long process."
News in brief. City of Dubuque, other local groups receive grants to promote arts. The City of Dubuque is among a group of local organizations receiving grants to promote arts and cultural experiences following the COVID-19 pandemic. The City's Office of Arts and Cultural Affairs is receiving $15,000 to work with Travel Dubuque to launch a marketing plan and tourism strategy to showcase the variety of creativity, events, venues, and cultural experiences in the community, according to a press release from the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs. The department awarded $1 million total in grants to 118 groups aimed at encouraging residents to re-engage with arts and cultural experiences. The grants were created with funds from the Federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. Other grant recipients are Guttenberg Development and Tourism, $7,700, Guttenberg Gallery and Creativity Center, $3,900, Bell Tower Theater in Dubuque, $10,800, Creative Adventure Lab in Dubuque, $17,000, Dubuque Chorale, $3,200, Dubuque County Historical Society, $6,100, Dubuque Museum of Art, $9,500, Five Flags Center in Dubuque, $11,300, Grand Opera House in Dubuque, $8,000, Heritage Center in Dubuque, $18,000, Julian Dubuque International Film Festival in Dubuque, $3,500, Loras College Center for Dubuque History, $1,500, Steeple Square in Dubuque, $8,800, and Onward Fine Arts Center in Maquoketa, $7,500. Dubuque American Legion to host Veterans Day event, Chili Feed. Dubuque American Legion Post 6 will host a Veterans Day ceremony at 10:30 a.m. Thursday, November 11th at Mystique Community Ice Center on Chaplain Schmidt Island. The featured speaker at the free event will be Rich Billmeyer of Epworth, Iowa. A graduate of Wallard Catholic High School and a member of the U.S. Army Reserve, he served in Iraq from 2006 to 2007 and in Afghanistan, where he was injured in Helmand Province in 2011, according to a press release. He was medically retired from the Army in 2013. The East Dubuque, Illinois Drum and Bugle Corps and the Dubuque Fire Pipe and Drums will provide music. Katie McFarland will sing the national anthem. The public is invited to attend the annual Chili Feed following the ceremony at 11:30 a.m. at the American Legion Club Room, 1306 Delhi Street. The The cost for a bowl of chili is $1. Dubuque NAACP holding annual turkey giveaway this month. The Dubuque branch of the NAACP will hold its annual turkey giveaway on November 20th. The 7th annual event will be held at 11 a.m. and run until supplies run out at Comiskey Park, 255 East 24th Street. Turkeys are available on a first-come, first-served basis, with one available per family, according to an online announcement. Donations to purchase the turkeys, which are $15 each, are being accepted until 1 p.m. Saturday, November 13th. Those interested in donating can email Miguel Jackson, Vice President of the local NAACP, at miguel.jackson67@gmail.com.
The following article is from the opinion page of the Telegraph Herald. Complex worker shortage could use an innovative solution. Where we currently stand, the low unemployment in Dubuque and the surrounding area indicates workforce shortage is a wider and deeper problem than first thought. By now, nearly everyone in the Dubuque area has felt the impact of the worker shortage. For many working people, it means extra duties, extra hours, and extra days of work to fill the void left by vacant positions. Companies are getting few, if any, applicants to fill jobs that once would have seen a pile of resumes. Area residents looking to stop at a restaurant or retailer might have encountered a place closed up early because of a lack of staffing. Because this worker shortage comes on the heels of the pandemic, there is a tendency to want to link these events. For a while, there was an assumption that after months of unemployment, supplemented by pandemic stimulus aid, workers just weren't in a hurry to go back to work. Now, we know that's not really an accurate picture. Dubuque County's unemployment rate fell to 2.9% in September, down from 4.6% the same month last year. All 10 counties in the Telegraph Herald readership area, which covers portions of Iowa, Wisconsin, and Illinois, observed drops in the September jobless rate compared to both the previous month of August and the same month the previous year, September 2020. Unemployment in Dubuque County is lower than both the national rate, 4.8% in September, and the statewide rate of 4%. It's only slightly higher than the 2% unemployment reported in Dubuque County in September of 2019, before the pandemic altered the economic landscape. That's a pretty good indication that the worker shortage has little to do with unemployment. Here's an even sharper contrast. In September of 2021, 1,600 Dubuque County residents received unemployment benefits, 500 more than in September of 2019. But the number of individuals employed or actively seeking employment dropped dramatically in that time frame, from 57,000 in September of 19 to 54,000 in September 21. That's 3,000 fewer people either working or seeking work, and that's a challenge. When Governor Kim Reynolds in June suspended federal supplemental benefits to the unemployed, the move resulted in little change in the worker shortage. That's because the reduction in workers over the past 2 years is not caused primarily by individuals milking unemployment benefits, Rather, it's the result of individuals choosing to leave the workforce altogether. That has created a difficult workforce climate, putting more pressure on employers than ever. We're seeing that already with wages climbing locally and signing bonuses being dangled. This might further manifest itself in offering positions with benefits or, for the biggest and most creative innovative companies, helping to figure out the child care piece. Additionally, with so many openings among full-time jobs with benefits, there likely are fewer people available to work part-time jobs, which often round out the workforce at restaurants, bars, and retailers. Folks aren't as interested in working multiple part-time jobs when they can go to a manufacturer and get 40 hours with benefits and a retention bonus. All of these factors are combining to force a redefinition of various industries. Some employers will not survive without really evaluating how employees fit into the equation. Surely this new employment picture is not lost on those involved in the John Deere and Company strike. Workers likely feel emboldened to hold out what they feel they deserve when they know the scarcity of workforce. When Dubuque saw highest in the nation unemployment rates in the 1980s wreak havoc on the local business climate, most people would have thought unemployment rates of less than 3% would be the answer to all problems. In fact, like most things in business, there's a balance required. Complex economic problems call for innovative and nuanced solutions. It will take all the stakeholders to develop strategies to right-size the workforce in the greater Dubuque area.
Much at stake in John Deere negotiations. By Rick Dickinson, Greater Dubuque Development Corporation, Molly Grover, Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce, and Danielle Peterson, United Way of Dubuque Area Tri-States. There is a lot at stake. If you are from Dubuque, you know that there are very few things that touch your life as often as John Deere. As individuals, we find our fellow softball teammates, PTA members, and next-door neighbors are lifelong John Deere workers. As businesses, we know that John Deere is one of our biggest customers and most trusted partners. As a community, it is hard to miss that John Deere executives and employees serve on our nonprofit boards, volunteer at every community event, and that in just the past year, the company donated over $1 million to local initiatives and charities. And as an economic engine, well, there really is no equal. Thousands of employees, hundreds of millions in recent expansions and investment, and the envy of other communities that have seen their manufacturing industries and jobs decline. So we all know there is a lot at stake these days. Our 75-year history with John Deere Dubuque Works as a local employer of choice has been a critical part of this community's success. And the strong, loyal workforce from this region has been a critical part of John Deere's success. Generations of our kids have been raised and new generations of their equipment have been launched. John Deere was the great job with great benefits. John Deere workers were the productive workers who outperformed other plants to bring more work here. Continuing that will be a big part of the next 75 years of Dubuque's success. Yes, there's a lot at stake, but given how critical John Deere is to this community, we are confident that issues will be resolved and the successful partnership will continue. And that is something we very much look forward to.
Funerals. You're listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Your reader is Bernadette
and Lois.
If you have any comments on this or on any IRIS program, please call 243-6833 or toll-free at 877-404-4747. And don't forget, this and many other IRIS programs are available from our website at theiowaradioreading.org. And now we return to the Telegraph Herald.
Obituaries. Marcia C. Hamill. Marcia C. Everest Hamill, age 76, of Dubuque, was called home peacefully at 6:35 p.m. on Monday, November 1st, 2021, at Manor Care Health Services, with her family by her side. To celebrate Marcia's life, family and friends may visit from 3 p.m. until 6:30 p.m. on Monday, November 8, 2021, at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street. Funeral services will be held at 6:30 p.m. on Monday at Bear Funeral Home, with Deacon Bill Biver officiating. Burial will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Marcia was born on May 27, 1945, in South Bend, Indiana, daughter of John and Lorraine Thompson Everest. Marcia attended school in South Bend, where she graduated from Washington Clay High School. She married the love of her life, Ronald L. Hamill, on October 15, 1966, in Dubuque. They raised their two children and enjoyed over 50 years of marriage together, before Ron was called home on October 20th, 2016. She and Ron were inseparable, and after they married, Marcia fully embraced her role as a wife, mom, and homemaker. All who knew her were amazed at the meticulous care she took of her home, and her laundry skills were legendary. Marcia was never afraid of hard work, and throughout the years she also worked outside of her home with Sieg Auto Parts Dubuque Telephone Answering Service, and lastly, as a receptionist at AAA Travel in Dubuque. Marcia's faith was very important to her, as was evidenced by her longtime membership with St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. Family was always Marcia's top priority, and she was everyone's biggest cheerleader. She kept track of what everyone was doing, providing daily encouragement, and was supportive of any endeavor they decided to undertake. When she found some quiet time, Marcia enjoyed spending it on her computer, reading, playing games, and keeping in touch with family and friends. She never let anything hold her back from enjoying life and always did things her way. We are truly heartbroken at losing our mom and grandma. We were not ready to let her go just yet. However, we are grateful that she no longer has to fight the health issues she has been dealing with, and is resting peacefully. Those left to cherish Marcia's memory include her children, Ronald L. Rebecca Edmonds Hamill II, Dubuque, Iowa, and Jacqueline Kevin Ansell, Dubuque, Iowa, 6 grandchildren, Michael John Hamill, Timothy Hamill, Elijah Hamill, Caden Ansell, Kendra Ansell, and Kira Ansell, her former daughter-in-law Darcy Hamill, Dubuque, Iowa, her brothers-in-law Tom Zwack, Roger Dean, William Levon Hamill, and Gerald Carol Hamill, all of Dubuque, a sister-in-law Jean Hamill, and many cousins, nieces, and nephews. Marcia was preceded in death by her parents and her loving husband of 50 years, Ronald L. Hamill. Marcia's family would like to thank all of the nurses and staff of Manor Care and Hospice of Dubuque for all of their compassionate care of Marcia these past weeks. The family will thankfully receive your support through phone calls, greeting cards, and memorials in Marcia's memory, which may be mailed to Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main Street, in charge of Marcia Hamill family. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.bearfuneralhome.com.
Mary C. Pink. Mary C. Pink, 93, of Manchester, Iowa, passed away on Friday, October 29, 2021, at the Good Neighbor Home, Manchester, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 5 to 7 p.m. on Sunday, November 14, 2021, at the Bowen Camp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester, with a scripture service beginning at 4:30 p.m. Additional visitation will be held from 9 to 10 a.m. Monday, November 15th, at the funeral home. Mass of Christian burial will follow at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 15th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Manchester, with the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. The interment will be at the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Cedar Rapids. Mary was born October 31, 1927, in Balltown, Iowa, the daughter of Leon and Clara Breimeyer Breitbach. She graduated from St. Joseph Academy in Dubuque in 1946. Mary married Bernard J. Munsell on June 28, 1947, in Balltown, Iowa. Six children were born to this unit. Bernard passed away on February 23, 1970, and Mary married Dr. James Pink on December 29, 1973, in Cedar Rapids. The couple made their home in Manchester, where they raised their family. Mary was a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church in Manchester. She enjoyed spending the winter in Mesa, Arizona with Jim, and loved spending time with her family. Mary lived a life of purpose and deep faith. A stronger person would be hard to find. Her heart and spirit were always loving. Mary is survived by her children, Susan Robert Plemons, Kathleen Wayne Volan, Stephen Paula Musil, David Musil, James Stacy Musil, stepchildren Teresa Tom Wickman, Kenneth Mary Pink, James Pink, and son-in-law Dr. John Leonard, sisters Shirley, Carolyn, Betty, Jean, and Clara, brothers Paul, Jerry, Larry, and 16 grandchildren, with 13 great-grandchildren and many nieces and nephews. She was preceded in death by her parents, Leon and Claretta Breitbach, her first husband, Bernard J. Musil, her second husband, James W. Pink, beloved daughter, Dr. Karen Musil Leonard, sisters Anna Velman, and brothers Peter, Joseph, Charles, and Philip. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Mary's Church, St. Mary's School, or the Good Neighbor Home. Memories can be shared at www.murdochfuneralhome.com. Elmer James Phillip of Scalesmount, Iowa. Elmer James Phillips, 78, of Scalesmount, and formerly of Galena, Illinois, died Saturday, November 6, 2021. Visitation will be held from 2 to 4 p.m. on Sunday, November 14th, at the Furlong Funeral Home in Galena.
Timothy J. McNamara. Timothy J. McNamara, 69, of Dubuque, Iowa, died November 4th at University Hospital in Iowa City. Visitation will be from 3 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, November 9th, at the Eaglehoff, Siegert & Casper Funeral Home, 2659 Kennedy Road, where there will be a wake service at 8 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be at 1 p.m. Wednesday at St. Raphael's Cathedral, followed by burial at Mount Calvary Cemetery. Tim was born on December 7, 1951, in Dubuque, the son of William and Irma Fry McNamara. He graduated from Wallert High School in 1969 and attended Loras College. On October 10, 1999, he married Davida Fink Hogan in Dubuque. He began his career in the family business, Mary Mac Family Shopping Service. From 1991 to the present, he was president of Will Mac Property Corporation. He also worked as a ski instructor at Sundown for many years. Tim enjoyed a remarkable life full of adventure, friends, and the arts. He had a vision for transformation of the historic Millwork District into an area for living, working, and entertainment, and he worked tirelessly toward that goal, promoting it to anyone who would listen. He imagined the area as a hub for the arts community in Dubuque and was a co-founder of the Voices from the Warehouse District art shows. He was a longtime member of the Dubuque Rotary Club. A beloved husband, father, brother, uncle, and friend, Tim gave love to everyone and every moment around him. He taught his nieces and nephews to ski, mountain bike, and use power tools. Tim's passion for music was epic, often leading to family jam sessions. He loved exploring with his grandchildren and long walks with his girls, Sophie, Margot, and his beloved wife. Tim had physical challenges since he was young, but never let it stop him from doing what he wanted to do, whether skiing, sailing, climbing, mountain biking, playing piano, or reconstruction of his homes or old buildings. He is survived by his wife, Davida, children David, Samantha Hogan of Urbandale, Iowa, Grace, Kristen Schultz Hogan of West Palm Beach, Florida, three grandchildren, Drake, Lucy, and Leo Hogan, his sister, Ellen David Carnahan, and brother, Patrick Christine McNamara, many nieces and nephews and extended family. He is also survived by the entire Tully clan, of which he was an honorary brother. He is preceded in death by his parents and his in-laws, Milton and Pearl Fink. A Tim McNamara Memorial Fund has been established. If you're lucky enough to be Irish, you're lucky enough.
Lou A. Wilhelm. Lou Ann Wilhelm of Dubuque, Iowa, passed away peacefully in her sleep of natural causes on Saturday, October 30th, 2021. Lou spent her younger years in Rockford, Illinois, before moving to Arizona, where she continued her love of camping and the outdoors. She was known for her love of get-togethers with family and friends, and was quick to lend a hand to anyone in need with a smile. Surviving her are sisters Mary Kahn of Sanibel, Florida, Sue Scala of Fort Myers, Florida, Deb Vanderhaar of Holy Cross, Iowa, Cheryl Wilhelm of Dyersville, Iowa, and Karen Adams of Mount Pleasant, South Carolina. She was preceded in death by her parents, Walter and Rosie Wilhelm, and two sisters, Kathy Wolbrun and Linda Ludovici. The family would like to thank the Specialty Care and Hospice of Dubuque for their compassionate care. A celebration of life will be held at a later date.
Catherine W. Opper, Glenview, Illinois. Catherine Wilson Opper, 89, of Glenview and formerly of Dubuque, died peacefully on October 21st, 2021. Daughter of the late Paul Oren Wilson and Mary Grogan Wilson, and sister of the late Robert Wilson and Nancy Wilson Hercher, mother of the late Michael L. Opper, and mother-in-law of the late Stephanie Opper. Catherine married the late Donald H. Opper on December 26, 1959, at St. Francis Xavier Church in LaGrange, Illinois. They were happily married for 59 years. She is survived by her beloved children, Thomas E. Upper, Margaret Mark Gulick, Susan Mark Pasquella, and Paul E. Upper, and her cherished grandchildren, Hannah, Madeline, Catherine, and Sarah Gulick, John Michael and Catherine Pasquella, and Lucas Upper. She is also survived by her beloved brother, James B. Wilson, and her nieces and nephews. Catherine was raised in LaGrange, Illinois, and graduated from Lyon Township High School in 1950. She was LTHS's first female student council president. After a year at St. Mary's of Notre Dame, Catherine transferred to the University of Michigan and graduated in 1954. She was a member of Kappa Alpha Theta sorority. Catherine's first job was at the National Livestock Producer magazine in Chicago. Catherine earned a master's degree from Loyola University, Chicago. She began her teaching career at Riverside Brookfield High School in 1957. Catherine was a brilliant teacher, loved the importance of learning, and enjoyed her students. After moving to Dubuque, Iowa, she taught English for over a decade at Wallert Catholic High School, where she was honored in 2020 for her outstanding service. Catherine's life was devoted to her family, her friends, and the gifts and challenges of learning, teaching, and writing poetry. She was a devout Catholic and found solace and strength in her faith. Catherine loved music, school, travel, and art. She treasured her teachers and classmates at the Roberta Kuhn Center and her friends in the illegitimate theater of Western Springs. She encouraged her children and grandchildren to read, travel, and be curious, and was delighted by their calls to compare notes on books, movies, cooking, and worldly destinations. Catherine's award-winning writings bolstered her to publish her own collection of poetry, A Stroll Through My Soul. She collected friends, as her brother Jim says, and thrived on staying in touch. She was a fabulous hostess, a fearless cook, and a gifted pianist, and she was still taking literature and poetry classes until the pandemic stopped her at age 87. Visitation Friday, November 12, 2021, 11 a.m. until time of funeral mass, 12 p.m. at St. Raphael Cathedral, 231 Bluff Street, Dubuque, Iowa. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the Roberta Kuhn Center, 1150 Carmel Drive, Dubuque, Iowa, 520037991, 563-582-4155. Information, DonnellanFuneralHome.com, 847-675-1990.
Lloyd R. Harrington, Piasta, Iowa. Lloyd R. Harrington, 84, of Piasta, passed away on November 2nd, 2021, at Mercy One Medical Center. Visitation will be from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 9th, at the Epworth United Methodist Church, 102 East Main Street in Epworth, where services will be held at 6 p.m. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory in Dubuque, Iowa, is assisting the family. Online condolences may be left at www.leonardfuneralhome.com. Lloyd was born on January 21, 1937, in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the son of Ray and Edna Ledvina Harrington. He married Beverly Carlson on March 21, 1958, in Charlotte, Iowa. They later divorced. He worked for the Iowa Oil Company, retiring in 2002. He was a member of the Epworth Methodist Church and was involved in delivering meals for the Epworth Meal Program. Lloyd enjoyed going to the bluegrass festivals, NASCAR racing, and trains, but mostly he enjoyed time with his family. He is survived by his children, Jacqueline, Friend Greg Chapman Harrington, Darwin Roberta Harrington, and Eric Jenny Harrington. his grandchildren Tiffany Block, April Burkfield, Patrick Harrington, Jessica Harrington, Bryce Harrington, and Trevor Harrington, along with 10 great-grandchildren, and his special friend, Lynn Bloch. He was preceded in death by his parents. The family would like to thank the staff at Mercy Medical Center, Dr. Bland and Dr. Whalen, for the wonderful care they gave to Lloyd. Joseph Metcalf, Bloomington, Wisconsin. Joseph Metcalf, 88, of Bloomington, died Sunday, October 31st, 2021. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 11 a.m. on Friday, November 12th, at the St. Mary Help of Christians Catholic Church in Glen Haven, Wisconsin. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Friday at the church. Burial will be in the Glockel Cemetery in Glen Haven Township. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory of Bloomington is assisting the family.
Justin J. Heitzman, Seattle, Tacoma, Washington. Justin J. Heitzman, 38, of SeaTac, passed away at the University Washington Medical Center following a 14-month battle with acute necrotizing pancreatitis, a condition caused by one tiny gallstone. A memorial service was held in SeaTac on Wednesday, November 3rd at the Bonnie Watson Funeral Home on International Boulevard. A memorial funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. on Monday, November 8th, 2021, at St. Joseph the Worker Church, 2001 St. Joseph Street in Dubuque, Iowa, with family visitation held from 9 to 11 a.m. prior to services. Interment will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery in Dubuque. Justin Joseph was born on May 17, 1983, son of Ronald and Joan Sigworth Heitzman at Mercy Hospital in Dubuque, Iowa. He attended school at St. Joseph the Worker and Wallard High School, Dubuque, and Briarcliff University in Sioux City, Iowa. Over his career, Justin's employment addressed many aspects of the airline industry. Initially, in a Sioux City call center, he was employed by Northwest Airlines and Delta Airlines. There he met Nicole Trompeter, the love of his life. Together they relocated to Seattle, where Justin was employed by Alaska Airlines, British Airways, and most recently for Kenmore Air Harbor. Justin enjoyed his work at Kenmore and especially valued the close client relationships he developed as customer service supervisor at Boeing Field. Related to their shared love of flight, Justin and Nicole traveled globally to many exciting destinations. Justin is survived by his fiancée, Nicole Trompeter, and his canine companion, Miss Maisel, of SeaTac, Washington. His parents, Ron and Joni Heitzman of Dubuque, and his sister, Valerie Jesse Pullen of Asbury, Iowa. Also surviving are his aunts and uncles, Bill, Barb Heitzman, Jenny Sigworth, Jerry Angie Sigworth, Nicola Fox, Kurt Lindstrom, and his cousins, Ryan, Emmy, Carl, J.P., Stacy, James, and Darcy. He was preceded in death by his grandparents, Norbert and Agnes Heitzman, and Celestine and Eleanor Sigworth, and his uncle, John Sigworth. The family wishes to thank the University of Washington Medical Center staff for their unwavering dedication to Justin's care throughout this very complex health event. We especially wish to recognize his primary surgeon, Dr. Karen Horvath, for her lead management of Justin's care. Justin and his family adore her.
Dominican Sister Lynn A. Lisbeth. Sister Lynn, Alita Lisbeth, died at St. Elizabeth Manor in Footville, Wisconsin, October 31, 2021. She was born Lynn Ann to Lawrence and Mary Hagen Lisbeth on October 24, 1945, in Jonesboro, Arkansas. She is the oldest of four children. Sister Lynn is survived by two brothers, Kenneth and James, extended family, and the Dominican Sisters of Sinsinawa. From 1967 to 1977, she taught intermediate grade school students in Wisconsin and New York. This creative and faith-filled woman then spent time in Montana, Wisconsin, and Alaska as liturgist, pastoral associate, general counselor with the Dominicans, retreat director, or spiritual companion. Her yes to life was clear and contagious. Services will be held at Sinsinawa November 8th and 9th. Casey McNutt Funeral Home is handling the arrangement. Sister Lynn now lives in God. She lives in eternal delight. This brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Sunday, November 6th. I'm your reader, Bernadette.
And I'm Lois.
Support for this reading comes from the DePaco R.W. Hoffer Foundation. The Telegraph Herald can be heard each weekday at 2 p.m. All programs heard on IRIS are intended solely for the blind and print handicapped. If you have any questions or comments on this or on any IRIS program, please call our office toll-free at 877-404-4747. And thanks for listening.